condensed matter system, and it's really like a statistical system in the sky. And just like in the lab, sometimes you have a system which, if you tune its temperature, lets you dial into a critical point. In the same way, a black hole has a temperature which is linked to its deviation from externality or its spin. And if you tune the spin carefully, in this case, if you go to externality, you approach a critical point. There's a critical temperature, which is zero temperature for the case of a black hole. And at the critical point, which is at externality, you have a conformal symmetry that has emerged. It's exact at the critical point, slightly broken as you move away from it. But just as in the case of condensed matter physics, which is perhaps familiar, as you approach the critical temperature, you can tell how fields scale. And usually they have a scaling behavior, which goes like T minus TC to some power. And this is called the critical exponent. So at externality, you have the full symmetry. But even if you move slightly away from it, the symmetry constrains the leading behavior of fields as you tune into the critical point. So I guess the theme of the talk is, let's think about black holes as examples of extremal black holes as example of critical points in astronomy. And let's try and use this reasoning, this type of reasoning, to constrain the physics of, in this case, electromagnetic fields and magnetospheres around rapidly spinning black holes as you tune into externality. So I guess the new things that I want to talk about, I'll say a few things about magnetospheres and force-free electrodynamics, which are the equations that describe the plasma around a black hole. But as a result of this type of analysis, which I'll explain, some of the upshots that we found is that we can explain the black hole Meissner effect for vacuum electromagnetic fields. And it basically arises as a direct consequence of the symmetry that emerges as you dial into this critical point. And then we'll also see that if you have a force-free plasma, there is no black hole Meissner effect, and energy extraction can take place all the way to externality. And finally, some of you might have heard about the BSW effect, Banyado-Silk-West, which says that it is possible to have infinite energy of mass collisions, infinite center of mass energy collisions around an extremal black hole. And this also becomes clear in this type of analysis. OK, so that was the introduction. And that's what I want to talk about. So let me very briefly summarize the Blanford-Znaik mechanism and derive the equations of force-free electrodynamics very quickly for you to explain why we're interested in this. So if you have a black hole in the sky in GR, we know because of a no-hair theorem that such a black hole can only be described by three parameters: the mass, the angular momentum, and the charge. Now, for various reasons related to this mechanism, we don't think that actual black holes in the sky have a charge. So really, they're parameterized by two numbers: the mass and the angular momentum. And the solution in GR, which describes such an object, is the Kerr metric. And the Kerr metric, in general, has two symmetries: a Killing vector dt, which generates time translations, and the Killing vector d phi, corresponding to axis symmetry. I was hoping to write the Kerr metric on the board before the talk, but I'm going to assume that you've seen it before. It's parameterized by a spin parameter, A, which is defined to be the ratio of the angular momentum to the mass. So this is the spin parameter that you can dial in your metric. Changing A corresponds to dialing the spin of the black hole. So in general, it's going to be spinning. When A equals 0, you have no angular momentum, so you're in Schwarzschild. And you have an SO3 symmetry on top of the time translation symmetry. As soon as you set the black hole spinning, the SO3 symmetry gets broken. You're left with only the d phi. And the event horizon of the black hole is located at, well, there's two, an outer and an inner one. And they're located at these points. And from this formula, you can see that A over M must be less than or equal to 1. Because if you were to exceed this bound, then there would be no radius for the event horizon, and the singularity would be naked. So that would violate cosmic censorship, and we don't allow that. So this must be true. And equivalently, the angular momentum of a black hole is bounded by its mass squared. So an extremal black hole is one which has the maximal amount of angular momentum, which is J equals to M squared, or equivalently, A over M, the spin parameter equal to 1. Now, these are very interesting because a lot of black holes in the sky really do spin very fast. So for instance, I think Cygnus X1 has a spin which is known to be greater than 0.983, for instance. And the Event Horizon Telescope will image two black holes, Sagittarius A star, which is the one at the center of our galaxy, and also M87, which is thought to be rapidly spinning. So this parameter is probably 0.9. There's different estimates. There's lower bound of 0.7. Okay. So one feature of this formula is that you can see as A tends to M and you approach extremality, the two horizons coalesce. And very funny things can happen. One thing that's interesting about black holes is, let me rewrite this formula in the following form. So really, the outer event horizon, which is what I've drawn here, is defined by this formula. But now let me define a new surface, which I'm going to call the ergosphere, by inserting a cos squared of theta. So now I've changed this formula by adding a cos squared of theta. And this surface kind of looks like this if you're near extremality. It's like an apple. And this surface is equivalent, or is defined by the condition that k mu is equal to 0. In other words, the time translation generator becomes null on the surface. So it's time-like here, which is the case we're all familiar with, but it becomes space-like in here. And what that means is that it opens up the possibility that you might have negative energy trajectories. So Penrose first described this in 69. And this is known as the Penrose process. It is possible to come in here, drop some matter on a negative energy geodesic, and then come out with more energy than you had going in, because you've lost negative energy, so you've gained positive energy. In other words, this is a mechanical process that allows you to extract energy. And already Penrose said, probably for the astrophysical case, it would be more interesting to consider energy extraction by electromagnetic fields. So what does that look like? Is that possible? And Blanford and Znaek came up with a mechanism in the 70s that said that the answer is yes. And here are the equations they considered. So their model, briefly, says consider such a black hole that's rotating. In general, the black hole will have an accretion disk that goes up to some radius that's called the ISCO, for innermost stable circular orbit. This is the last radius at which particles can just orbit around the black hole. Beyond this point, they just plunge in. And there's various astrophysical arguments that probably not going to bother sketching now, that say that generically, you'd expect this region to be populated by a plasma. So in other words, you set your black hole spinning. If there's a background magnetic field, there's going to be pair production in the vacuum that's going to go on until there's some plasma that just populates the region around the black hole. Eventually, this pair production will stop because the electric field will be screened. And the end result will be that the black hole will be sheeted in a plasma. So then, OK, that's an interesting generic story. But what are the equations that describe this setup? Well, in general, you know that if you look at a point in this region, the stress energy at that point will be given by a contribution from the electromagnetic field that surrounds the black hole. And also, there will be a contribution from the matter that makes up the plasma. Now, in the Blanford-Znaek model, if you look at the estimates of how this plasma comes about, you find that the density is fairly low compared to the energy in the fields. In other words, most of the energy in the system is stored in the electromagnetic fields, not in the matter fields, not in the plasma. So that means you can approximately set this to 0. And then you end up with this force-free condition, which is the one approximation that you need to make to obtain equations of motion for this plasma, which is the following. So of course, this is an approximation. And this is known as the force-free condition. Now, why do we call this the force-free condition? Very briefly, remember, I'm going to write this. This is very familiar to everyone. This is the Lorentz force law. You can make it into a Lorentz force density if you're describing a continuous plasma. And the relativistic version of this is F nu is equal to F mu nu J nu. Okay? So now we're going to quickly obtain the equations describing this plasma. So there's an electromagnetic field. So therefore, it must obey the Maxwell equations. This is what we mean by an electromagnetic field. Of course, we must have this constraint. The two form is closed. And on top of that, we impose this condition. Now, it is always true in GR that the stress energy tensor is conserved. But now, because of our approximation, we can say that we must impose this additional condition. And if you look at the definition of the stress energy tensor in ENM, F nu alpha minus 1 4 g mu nu F squared, if you act with the covariant derivative and you use the Maxwell equations, you find that this is exactly, you find that this is exactly minus F nu. So the interpretation is that the change in the energy is related to the Lorentz force density. And so this condition therefore tells us that delta mu nu T mu nu ENM must be 0. So equivalently, F nu, which is F mu nu J mu, is 0. So these are the force-free equations. So these are the equations that we're interested in solving. Now, of course, the real black hole has a lot of messy stuff happening. But there's numerical simulations which suggest that really these equations are a good approximation, at least in part of this region. But I should emphasize these equations are really ubiquitous. The only assumption that went into them is that you had a plasma of low particle density relative to the energy stored in the electromagnetic fields. So the sun apparently has a force-free corona. You can go on YouTube and you can see it. It looks like a ballerina dancing. People in the last couple of years have produced force-free plasmas in the lab. These equations also apply in the context of pulsars and other stellar phenomena. So really, these are really nonlinear equations in physics that arise quite generally, and they're interesting to study in their own right. And I think in the last few years, we found that they have a very interesting structure. So there's a lot to explore here. Now, let me give you a quick summary of what is known about solutions to these equations. Essentially, Blanford and Znajek found solutions to these equations in flat space and then matched them onto approximate solutions in Schwarzschild and then perturbed those to get approximate solutions in Kerr, which held at low spin. It was an expansion in this small parameter. And they found that there was energy extraction. So there really was energy coming out in a vaguely conical region around the poles. So that's what convinced people that black hole energy extraction mechanisms existed. But there were really no exact solutions in Kerr until much later in the 2000s, when Menon and Dermer found one exact solution. But it has some odd physical characteristics. So the problem of solving these equations in Kerr is still open. It's very, very hard. And thankfully, you've got plenty of people who do numerics, so we have some understanding of what happens. But it would be really nice to also have some exact solutions that we can play with analytically. Now, in particular, when A over M is small, you can play with these equations in flat space where they're somewhat simpler, and then you can do some perturbation expansions. And also the numerics work really well. But if you crank this parameter close to extremality, so if you make the black hole spin faster and faster, as you get closer and closer to extremality, the numerics get a lot harder. But miraculously, this is also where the symmetries come in to save you. So there's a symmetry enhancement that occurs in the limit where A tends to M. And one way to think about this is to recall that a black hole has the Kerr metric has a temperature which is equal to R plus minus M over 4 pi M R plus. And when you go to extremality, R plus tends to M, and so the temperature of the black hole tends to zero. So if you consider the Kerr family of solutions parameterized by this parameter, clearly the point A equals zero is special, you have more symmetry, it's in Schwarzschild, but somehow it looks like the simplest member of this family is really the Kerr black hole, because in some sense it's a ground state. It has zero energy. As I'm now going to argue, in fact, it is much simpler, and the region around the horizon, as you go to extremality, has an enhanced symmetry group. So instead of just having U1 times U1 for time translation symmetry and axis symmetry, there will be a symmetry enhancement. And the time translation part of the symmetry group gets enhanced to be part of an SL2R. So let me sketch this now. Again, unfortunately, I didn't have time to write the Kerr metric. But if you're familiar with the Kerr metric in Bohr-Lindquist coordinates, you can define, starting with Bohr-Lindquist coordinates in Kerr, you can define new coordinates, which are going to be the net coordinates in this manner. Okay, and if you take the Kerr metric and you set A equals to M, then you end up in extremal Kerr. And then you take your Bohr-Lindquist coordinates in extremal Kerr, you do this coordinate transformation, and you end up with lambda-dependent coordinates. But you can take the limit as lambda goes to 0. This is the so-called neck limit for near-horizon extremal Kerr. And you end up with the following metric. Ds squared is 2m squared gamma minus r squared dt squared plus dr squared over r squared plus d theta squared plus lambda squared d phi plus r dt, which I assure you is much, much simpler than the full Kerr metric. And in fact, this has the structure of an ADS3. If you just look at this and that, this is ADS3. There's also a warping factor. So this is like warped ADS3, warped over a circle. But there's a lot of intuition that can carry over from ADS spaces. So if you've played with those, this shouldn't be so unfamiliar. And in particular, you can look at this metric and ask how many Killing vectors it has. And indeed, you'll find that its symmetry group is SL2R times U1. So you had the Killing vector K in Kerr, which survives. I'm going to add a square root of 2 to make the commutation relations work out the way I want. But now, so this is time translation symmetry. Now you have an additional Killing vector, which we're going to call H0. And this, you can see from its form, corresponds to a dilation symmetry. There's also an H minus, which has a more complicated form. I'm not going to write it down. It's the analog of global time translations in ADS2. And together, these guys form the following commutation relations, which are the defining commutation relations of the symmetry group SL2R, which is the global part of the conformal group. And of course, additionally, you still have d phi, which generates the U1. It commutes with all of these guys. So that's the structure. Okay. Now, the one I'm going to focus on is the dilation symmetry. I don't have a good intuitive reason to see why this appears, but this dilation symmetry naturally emerges in this limit in a way that I'm going to sketch now. So the finite form of this transformation is to take r to a constant times r and t to t divided by that constant. So this is an infinitesimal transformation which generates this finite symmetry transformations. And now what I want to do is consider an arbitrary tensor field in Kerr. So let's suppose we have a tensor field W in Kerr, which can have as many indices, let's say mu 1 through mu r. So it's a tensor field of rank r. So suppose I have such a field in extreme Kerr. Then I can take my Born-Lindquist coordinates and do this coordinate transformation. And now this guy will have coordinates, a coordinate expression which depends on lambda. So I'm going to assume that the field is analytic, which is a mild assumption to make. And I can then expand it in lambda. So I can write W, this is my field in extreme Kerr, is equal to lambda to the minus h, where I'm going to call h the weight of the field, times W bar plus lambda W bar 1 plus 1 half lambda squared W bar 2 plus so on. So this is something I'm doing in extreme Kerr. Now, the leading behavior, as I take lambda to 0 and end up in this neck geometry, the leading behavior can equivalently be expressed as W bar. So this is this guy, the leading piece, is therefore the limit as lambda goes to 0 of lambda to the h times W. So intuitively, what you're doing is you're taking your tensor field in Kerr, and you're basically taking lambda to 0. Now, if in general, you could either get something that blows up, or you could get something that goes to 0. But there's a precise power h, which is such that if you multiply by lambda to the h, then this limit gives you something finite and non-zero. So this is what we mean by this weight h of the field. And of course, it depends on the specifics of what the tensor field in Kerr is. Now note that this limit is invariant under lambda goes to lambda c. And as you can see from this, this is equivalent to this transformation. So therefore, this object must be invariant under this. Or rather, in general, W bar must scale like c to the minus h W bar. If I do this rescaling, this is how this guy rescales. And this is just the finite form of a statement which we can write in terms of the infinitesimal symmetry generator as the derivative of along h0 of w bar is equal to h times w0 of w. So this was a bit fast, but there's a more formal proof in the paper that's about to come out soon. Okay, this was maybe a lot of math, but the upshot is if you start with a physical field in extremal Kerr, and you ask how does it scale as you go into the neck limit, in condensed matter language, we would say, what is the leading behavior as you approach the conformal point? This is the universal piece that should be constrained by the emergent conformal symmetry. The answer is, this leading piece, from the point of view of neck, is a very special field. It's a field that is self-similar under infinitesimal, under dilations. And the infinitesimal version of the statement is this. So now, if you want a field which is stationary and axisymmetric, can I move this up? How does No. Oh. So suppose you want a field that's stationary Well, that's equivalent to saying that the derivative along H plus, which is like the time derivative of the field, is zero. If you want it to be axisymmetric, that's like saying that you want the lead derivative along the U1 generator, d phi, to be zero. And now I've argued that the leading piece must also obey the so-called highest weight condition, which is very familiar. It shows up in string theory all over the place if you've ever looked at ADS. If you want to solve the wave equation in ADS or anything like that, you'll also impose this kind of condition. So when we first started this project, we just kind of guessed that these were the right conditions to impose. And we imposed them, and we found many, many, many solutions. In fact, there's a paper with Maria Rodriguez and Andy in which we found several infinite classes of solutions. But we didn't really understand what the physical significance of these conditions was. And also, we didn't know what the physically relevant one was. So now I think I can explain why we should impose these conditions. They're really, stationarity and axisymmetry, together with the requirement that you want to pick out the leading behavior as you tune into the critical point. OK, so now this weight h that you need to rescale by depends on the particular field w, but it's always bounded by the rank. So if you have a field of rank r with r indices, h must always be less than or equal to r. And this comes from the fact that when you take the limit from cur to neck, you have a transformation with a Jacobian that is of order lambda inverse. So if you have r indices, you can act with something that is at most of order lambda to the minus r, which is where this condition comes from. But this is an upper bound. And of course, there are special cases. So for instance, the metric is a field with two indices. So you could expect h to be less than or equal to 2. But in fact, h is equal to 0. And this is just the statement that the metric is dilation invariant, or that h0 is a Killing vector, or equivalently, that of course you've taken, to define the metric, you've taken the limit where you've dilated infinitely many times. So of course, the outcome is something that's dilation invariant. It's not surprising that, in other words, it's not surprising that h0 becomes a Killing vector under the limit lambda goes to 0, because you're essentially dilating infinitely many times. As far as I know, there's no intuitive reason for why h minus also pops up. Now, if you consider a two-form f mu nu, this has two indices. So again, h can be at most 2. But because it's anti-symmetric, if you look at the details, in fact, you will find that it can have h less than or equal to 1. OK, so now what I want to explain is, using what we've learned, that these are the conditions to impose, what is the universal leading behavior of a stationary axisymmetric electromagnetic field in extreme curve? What can we learn about this? Well, before saying that, let me just point out that whenever h is positive, your field W in general becomes null in neck. And by null, I mean that all the scalar invariants that you can construct out of it become zero. So let me give you an example. Suppose I have a vector field V mu. This is my V. Under this condition, it can have an expansion, which begins at most at order lambda to the minus 1. This will be the leading behavior, and there's subleading terms. Now, from this, you can contract v with itself. So take v mu dot v mu. That's v squared. And you find, again, it is crucial that the metric has weight h equals 0. You find that v squared is really lambda to the minus 2 v bar squared. If the metric didn't have weight h equals 0, this wouldn't be 2. But in this case, it is. Plus order lambda inverse. But now, note that v squared is in general, a regular scalar. And it has, in other words, rank 0, so its h is at most 0. In other words, it cannot have a lambda to the minus 2 piece, which therefore implies that v squared must be 0. OK, so this is kind of interesting. And spoiler alert, what I'm about to tell you is that the leading behavior of the electromagnetic field, you do some analysis, and what you find is that the leading piece, which has weight h equals to 1, must automatically have f squared equal to 0, which is a bit surprising because traditionally when people study force-free electrodynamics, they always assume f squared is positive, which is equivalent to the statement that the magnetic field is dominant over the electric field. So this is kind of interesting. OK, so let me tell you about these leading behaviors and give you some more detail about this. Now, in general, you can write, you can solve force-free electrodynamics in a perturbation expansion in this parameter lambda. So what do? You take your Kerr metric, your extreme Kerr metric, and you expand it into a neck piece plus leading correction, et cetera. And then you can take your stationary axisymmetric electromagnetic field in Kerr. And in general, it'll have weight h equals 1 for its leading piece. So you'll have a 1 over lambda. Let's call it f bar plus an f hat plus lambda f1, et cetera. Now, if you plug this into the force-free equations, you can solve them order by order in lambda. And essentially, you can reconstruct any solution to your equations in Kerr by starting by following this procedure. But that's not exactly what I want to be doing, although I can talk also about this. But what I'm more interested in is just saying, what is the leading behavior? So suppose I tune into extremality. What happens to this guy? What can I say about it? Can I constrain it using just the symmetries? So the answer is yes. The kinematics prove extremely constraining. So let me suppose that I just look at this part. I'm imagining that I'm really close to the critical point. So I write this. And now I'm going to impose some purely kinematic constraints. So I'm not going to impose, I'm not going to assume anything about the physics of this field. I don't know what dynamics it has. I don't know what the right equations of motion are. I'm just going to look at the dynamics. So if I require that it be stationary, if I require that it be axisymmetric, I know that it will have to be null. So it will have to have f bar squared equal to 0. I require that it be, that it have weight 1. It'd be weight 1 self-similar, which is just this condition. And on top of that, I require it to be regular on the future horizon, which is a physical, which is a, it's a physical, physically meaningful boundary condition to impose. And of course, I also want the form to be closed so that it corresponds to an electromagnetic field. Then from these purely kinematic constraints, I can basically completely determine f bar. So what I find is that f bar is equal to some function of theta. Notice that none of these symmetries act on theta, so that part is unrestricted, times d of t minus 1 over r, wedge d theta. OK? So I start with a stationary axisymmetric electromagnetic field in extreme Kerr. I assume it's regular on the future horizon. Then its leading behavior, as I tune in to the critical point, as I go into the horizon where the symmetry emerges, is exactly this. So it's completely determined by kinematic constraints up to a function of theta. So in some sense, it's universal. This is the universal leading behavior. The hope would have been that even this function gets fixed. So it's not quite as nice as that. In other words, you still need to say a little something about the dynamics to constrain this guy. So let me.
Can you fix this sub limit piece also in the same kind of
argument? Yes. So let me tell you. Good. This is so cool. You guys have the best equipment. Okay. So if you go back to this perturbation expansion argument, what you find is that this leading piece has a free function a of theta. I'm going to tell you in a second about the subleading piece, which is also going to have a free function that you can fix, b of theta. So there's a universal leading behavior and a universal subleading behavior, but they're not quite completely fixed. They still have two free functions of theta. But once you fix these two things, all the other guys are completely fixed by the equations, if you're doing force-free, for instance. So we're a bit puzzled by this, but you can relate these guys to physical quantities of force that describe force-free fields in Kerr. And essentially, what A and B tell you are if you go back to Kerr and you have some magnetic field lines, then you can look at the magnetic field lines on the horizon. And you can ask, what is the magnetic flux psi of theta on the horizon? And also, what is the current flux through each magnetic field line evaluated on the horizon? So these are two functions of theta. And essentially, from the perspective, you can solve force-free in extreme Kerr as a perturbation expansion problem coming out of the neck region, expanding in this lambda. And basically, picking A and B, it amounts to picking these two physical quantities, which describe the solution in Kerr. And then you've basically imposed boundary conditions on the event horizon. And then you expand out, and you can find the full solution in Kerr. So this is the form of this leading piece. Good. But now, let us suppose that for some reason, the leading piece dies. No? OK, so suppose that for some reason, this guy has died. And that's not so crazy. Why? Because if you compute the current associated with this, what you find is, let me call it J bar. This is the current associated with F bar. You find that it is, in fact, proportional to A of theta. There's a more complicated function of theta, but it's basically A of theta times D of t minus 1 over r. By the way, this defines a direction in the spacetime, which is the so-called ingoing principle null congruence. If it had been a plus, it would have been the outgoing one, and then you would have been regular on the past horizon, but not the future horizon.
Alex, and the f bar written that you did automatically satisfy the f square equals 0 requirement?
Yes. Okay. So in other words, what I'm saying is, these are kinematic constraints. It's there. And just from this, I automatically get this. I haven't used any equations of motion yet. The current associated with this F is this guy, has this form. If we were to assume that A of theta is 0, then there would be no current and no H equals 1 piece. And then you would have F equal to F hat plus something of order lambda. So this guy would be weight h equals 0. I'm not going to rewrite the list, but you basically do the same game. You ask that it be stationary, axisymmetric, null. And now, instead of weight 1 self-similar, your weight 0 self-similar, which really means you're invariant under dilation, your dilation invariant. And again, you want it to be regular on the future horizon and closed. And that allows you to uniquely fix this f hat. And what you find is the promised function b of theta, dt wedge dr plus b prime of theta, r dt plus d phi bar wedge d theta. So this guy is a one form, which if you were to raise it, would just be d phi mu. This is the lowered version of d phi mu in this metric. And this guy has a j mu, a current j mu, j mu hat, which is proportional to some function of b here, and then a d phi mu. And this had to be the case because d phi mu is the generator of the u1, which commutes with all the h's. So this is the only vector field that can commute with all the symmetries. And the solution has weight h equals to 0, and it's completely SL2R times u1 invariant. OK, good. So that was basically all the hard work. And now we can say a few things about physics. Yeah, so I
like play the same game, and I say, well, suppose the leading part and the first subleading part are not there, and then I try to solve the equations, then what you get a non-solution. How is it that you get the subleading part, the sub-subleading part?
Well, okay, so let me give you an example which I was hoping to talk about at the end. It's that of the vector field. So suppose you have a particle that's following some trajectory in Kerr. It's described by a four-velocity u mu. And then you say, OK, this is a time-like trajectory in Kerr. It has u dot u equals to minus 1. It's time-like. But by this argument, if the particle enters the neck region, then you would say, well, you know, I can expand it as, I can write this as lambda inverse u bar mu plus subleading. And then the description in Kerr would have u bar dot u bar equal to 0 by this argument. So then you're saying, oh, it looks like there's only two possibilities. Either my particle doesn't enter the neck region, and then I just don't see the neck, or it enters, but it's infinitely boosted, and it becomes null. But actually, it's more subtle, because there's a counterexample to this. We know that if particles spiral in on the ISCO, they're actually not going to be null. They're going to remain time-like in neck. Neck allows you to resolve the structure of particles on the ISCO. And the key point is that if you fine-tune your u, it is possible to make sure that this leading piece dies. And in the case of particles on the ISCO, indeed, this leading piece, which could exist but doesn't have to, vanishes. And then you start at the subleading order. In the same way, you know, in general, there's no reason why a of theta should vanish. But if you have some reason for why it should vanish, then this would be the next leading piece. Now, in fact, this guy can never be regular on both horizons. So if for some reason you think that you really should have something that's regular everywhere, including on the two horizons, then you would have to discard this, and this would really become your leading piece.
So the thing is, you couldn't assume the both.
Yeah, then if you have some magical reason to explain why a of theta and b of theta are both 0, then it could be that really the leading piece is h equals minus 1. So yeah. In fact, let me give you an example of this for vacuum Maxwell. So suppose that you're in a you're in a situation where you have your black hole and then you have charges and currents that don't enter the neck region. So that your electromagnetic fields, so that your electromagnetic field F Kerr is entirely sourced by things that are not in the neck region. Then the leading pieces in neck should satisfy the vacuum Maxwell equations because there's no charges there. So in that case, you would say this leading piece, because the charges and currents are not in the neck region, J should be 0, which means A of theta should be 0, which in turn implies that F bar should be 0. So if you have sources away from the horizon, if there are no sources that enter the near horizon region, then you have to solve the vacuum Maxwell equations, which implies that F bar, the guy with H equals to 1, must vanish. OK, so then this is a reason why you would discard this guy, and then you would go to the next piece. And now the next piece, again, should satisfy the vacuum Maxwell equations because there's no current. So you set the current J equal to 0. And here there's a scalar factor that depends on B of theta. And if you set that equal to 0, that fixes B of theta. And what you would find in that case is that B of theta is equal to QE cos G of theta minus QM sine G of theta, where I've written it in this form to make electromagnetic duality manifest. And here, cos G of theta is just gamma lambda squared, which are functions that appear in the metric, which is 1 minus cos squared theta over 1 plus cos squared theta. But if you want to be consistent with your assumption that there are no sources in the neck region, then the black hole itself cannot have charges. Remember, this is Q equals 0. So these two charges should be set equal to 0, which means that B of theta is also equal to 0. So in this case, both the leading piece and the subleading piece must vanish. And what that tells you is that F cur, when you take this limit, really has is really of order lambda 1 or even lower. And this is the Meissner effect. Why? Well, I mean, you can be a little bit more formal, but you can say that if you take the pullback of this transformation to neck, you take the pullback to Kerr, this is really equivalent to saying that F Kerr evaluated on the horizon is equal to 0. So in some sense, you can see that the kinematics impose very strong constraints. And if you, on top of that, say that there are no charges, you automatically get the what people call the black hole Meissner effect. It's almost a direct consequence of the symmetries. Now, what happens if you want to solve the force-free equations? If you want to solve the force-free equations, you play the same game. So there's no a priori reason to assume that the H equals 1 piece dies. So this would be your leading behavior. But now what's interesting is that you want to apply the force-free condition, F dot J equals 0, to these guys. However, note that they're really parallel. So this is automatically satisfied. In other words, force-free electrodynamics imposes no additional constraints on top of the ones that you get from the symmetry. It's trivial. So OK, I guess in some way this is perhaps a bit disappointing, because the hope was force-free electrodynamics is really hard. In Kerr, we can't find exact solutions, except some trivial ones. The hope was, let's use the symmetries to find the universal leading behavior. And unfortunately, it gets you partway, but it leaves you with this one undetermined function.
Sorry, so I have to go. I'm going to ask you this question. So
yeah.
We were chatting yesterday. This maybe you alluded to this in a bit. That you believe that okay, you're getting things at the near extreme curve, but then you can flow out of the near extreme curve to a degenerate situation. So we know that in the zero speed case, you wouldn't have a jet. Can you? Can that limit be taken? Can you take the limit all the way to no spinning black hole and get something sensible, or does it break away?
No, because well, okay, I should write. I was a bit sloppy. This is extremal Kerr, right? So I can set up this perturbation expansion to get out of neck back into the full geometry, which is extreme Kerr, but I can't deform away. I don't know of a way to do this. Yeah, it's like your question is like asking, can I use the conformal symmetry that I get at the critical point to say what happens very far away from it?
In some cases, you can.
In some cases, you can. Yeah. No, I really have nothing to say. OK, thank you.
Sorry, so are you saying that
No, there is. It's totally unconstrained.
How many three functions do you have?
A.
Just A. Okay.
In the leading piece. In fact, I can tell you what A corresponds to from the point of view of force-free physics in Fulker. This is really related to, so for those of you who know, well, like I alluded to, as I alluded to before, a force-free solution is characterized by a magnetic flux through a loop. This is a function psi. And it turns out that this A of theta, you can relate it back to properties of the field in Fulker. And it turns out to be given by this. So if you have a solution with magnetic field lines rotating at the same velocity as the horizon, or if for some reason there's no magnetic flux, so you assume a Meissner effect of some sort, then A of theta would be 0. And this subleading piece would vanish. Or like I said before, if you're not happy with regularity just on the future horizon, and you want regularity everywhere, you also have to make A of theta vanish. And in that case, the leading behavior goes to this. But now you have to apply the force-free conditions to this solution. And it turns out, because this is d phi mu, again, these pieces are parallel. So this condition tells you that this must vanish. So b prime of theta must be 0. And you automatically read off that your universal piece is really a constant b times dt wedge dr. And in fact, let me rewrite this as minus 2 over pi qe, where now the black hole carries a charge.
This is coming from saying that j dot f must vanish, right?
Yes.
But don't you have a contribution in next order to j? So how did you get your leading order currents? I would imagine you just take the divergence of that at each order, and that would give you the same order of contribution.
So I'm once again playing the same game. I'm asking, what is the leading behavior at extremality? Like, suppose I'm very close to extremity, I only need to look at the leading piece, can discard the rest. In general, the leading piece has h equals to 1. But suppose it's 0, then I forget about it. Now the leading piece is h equals to 0, which is this guy. And now this is the guy that I must impose force free on. Of course, I could keep adding subleading terms to get corrections, but they would be corrections to this guy. Ah, good. Well, after I've killed this solution, I don't get a current from this guy. So I take this f hat, I compute its j hat, which is very complicated. It's some function of b and its derivatives times d phi. And then I must assume that that is force free, which tells me that b prime has vanished. And so I really get this solution. Now, I will say one thing. This guy is a null. So f hat squared is not 0. And you might think, oh, great, is it positive? Actually, no, it's negative, which people would say is really bad, because that means the electric field dominates over the magnetic field. So physically, you expect there to be an instability, because everything gets accelerated away. The plasma should dissipate. Mathematically, if you look at the equations in a 3 plus 1 decomposition, they end up, the time evolution operator is elliptic, so that's also really bad from a mathematical standpoint. So you think it's bad. But like I said, really, this metric is kind of, where is it? My neck metric over there is really kind of like ADS. And it is well known that in ADS3, say, I don't think the dimension really matters. In ADS, you can have a radial electric field, which is exactly what this is. This is really a purely radial electric field. And you can have particles of both charges staying in circular orbits that are stable. Why? Because you have an electric field that pushes them out, but a gravitational pull that keeps them in. And if you tune the energies of the particles very precisely, it is possible to make them balance out. So this has been known for a really long time. And actually, we haven't totally worked this out yet, but it seems to work out the same way. In other words, of course, if you were in flat space and you had a solution with f squared negative, you would say, this is terrible, it's unstable. But here it appears that you can come up with some argument to indicate that, in fact, the solution is stable, because the plasma wants to dissipate due to the electric field, but the gravitational potential keeps it together. So this also appears to be a stable solution. I'm out of time, so I guess I'll just say it's kind of unclear. Well, if you look at the list of conditions, these are the ones that you want to impose really physically. And then you would get this leading behavior for force-free electromagnetic fields. It's not very satisfying because the kinematics almost fix everything, but then the dynamics at the end don't help you, and you're left with a free function. So it's not, the dream of having the symmetries completely fix the leading behavior doesn't really work out, unfortunately. The dream does work out, though, if you come up with some argument for why this should vanish, either from regularity or by saying that the field lines rotate, co-rotate with the event horizon, or that the magnetic flux vanishes for some reason, then this would be the leading piece. Now, you might think you're in trouble, but actually, you're probably not. And this would sort of fulfill the vision of having the symmetries completely fix the physics. Because this is totally determined. And also, I guess what's a bit weird is that usually you'd expect the leading behavior at a critical point to respect the symmetries. It would be natural to have the leading piece have H equals zero, which means it's totally invariant under the symmetries, and then you'd have corrections that would break the symmetry. It's kind of odd to say that the leading piece already breaks the symmetries. So maybe there's some reason we haven't figured out yet for why we should exclude this one. But anyway, these are the two solutions. And I guess I should really stop here. I'll just say in words, there's this famous BSW effect that says that you can have particles collide with infinite center of mass energy. And in this picture, what it comes down to is the existence of these two types of trajectories. So if you look at the black hole from above now, so it's spinning around this axis, if you throw in a particle and it enters the neck region, then by this argument, even though it started out time-like here, by the time it gets into neck, it's become infinitely boosted, so it's null. But if you have a disk with particles spinning on the ISCO, in the extrema limit, the ISCO kisses the horizon. So there are really particles in the neck region that are spinning around the black hole. And those are finely tuned to be time-like, so they're just kind of orbiting here around the black hole. And if you look at the equations in detail, what you find is that if they collide, the center of mass energy diverges. And there's two ways of looking at this. You're either looking at it from the far region, and from your point of view, you would say that the infinite energy comes from this particle because it's now moving on this ISCO radius, which is exactly on the event horizon. So it's really on a null trajectory because it's moving on the horizon, which is a null surface. So you'd say this is the guy that has the infinite energy, and you're just hitting it with a finite particle energy coming in. From the point of view of neck, it's the opposite. You would say this is the guy that has finite energy, and this is the infinitely boosted guy that has the infinite energy. But either way, you would say they have infinite energy in the center of mass. And I'll stop here. Thank you.
Basically to set your A of theta, I think. But that means that there are these simulations out there of MHD simulations, so you have a mass-dominated disk coming in, sourcing all of your currents, but then they have some nearly force-free polar region, et cetera. Do you have any interest in checking to see if those look like your solutions here? I mean, they certainly don't look like the second one, because there's always flux crossing the horizon. But they may look like your first one. Have you looked into comparing near the horizon? I realize that those are not maximal or extremal curves. Right? Can't really quite go up to extremal curves. But secondly. Yeah, so secondly, like they're not really force-free everywhere.
Yeah, so I think you're right to say that. I mean, I think this story is the right one. I think this is the leading piece. And the symmetry fixes almost everything, but not that function of theta. So you need to say something else to get it. And it's not the force-free equation. Basically, the force-free equations are trivial. They don't say anything. I should mention, really, if you assume that F was MHD, you'd end up, I think, with the same conclusion. So this is kind of more general. So whatever your stationary axisymmetric field F is, I think this is what it looks like. And then the A of theta, you have to fix in a different way. I think even analytically, you can come up with some clever guesses. Because you can take the monopole solution in Schwarzschild, which is known exactly. And then there's a way to kind of guess what it should be enhanced to as you dial up the spin. We can talk about that. There's a formula for that, which doesn't mean it's the correct one. Maybe you could get the correct one from numerical simulations. I think what I'm interested in is asking. Exactly. I mean, you don't have nothing because you already have this part. So I think there's a lot of effects that just follow from this. They're probably, I think you can say some things. I don't know how much, but you can definitely say some things that are independent of what A of theta is. So in particular, if you ask, what do particles moving, charged particles in your plasma that kind of fall into the neck region, how are they going to move? They're going to obey Lorentz force trajectories in the background of this F. And qualitatively, I think their behavior doesn't really depend on what A of theta is. Yeah, that's right. So if you want to play the perturbation expansion game, you can take this guy. Now, the leading piece will be this, which has F squared equal to 0. But then you can add the subleading piece, and then subleading pieces, and so on. And depending on what choice of A and B you make, once you get to high enough order, F squared will no longer be 0. Like, in fact, you can make it positive. So this is, I think, what you're saying. You can probably.
No, I'm saying you have a prediction that you can check. And at the moment, the shape of those field lines is entirely determined by unknown functions. And if you have an actual shape, regardless of what the strength is across those fields, if you have a shape that just comes out of symmetry, that would be interesting because that would eliminate.
Okay.
So we don't know. So I'm just wondering if you've checked. Go talk to Ramesh.
Yeah. I mean, this paper should have come out already. It's like there's a final draft that isn't completely out yet, but it will be in the next few weeks. And what we've been thinking about now is, can we make a prediction for what the event horizon will see purely from the symmetry? That would be like a universal prediction from conformal symmetry in the sky on something that the event horizon can potentially detect. That would be really cool. That's kind of the dream. And yes, I think this form does fix the shape of the magnetic field lines. They attend to this principal null congruence. And a lot of the physics that the HD will see seems to depend on this field line geometry. So we should talk about this. Yeah, so you can play this game exactly up to second order. And then, I am not strong enough to keep doing it by hand.
One thing that wasn't completely clear, so this expansion that you're doing, are you saying that like your typical solution will have this expansion, or is this like an assumption that you're putting on it? And if it's an assumption, like I'm used to imposing something like axis your stationarity.
Uh, So if the field exists in extreme Kerr, there's no extra assumption. I mean, this is the assumption that you can make that expansion that it's analytic means that the field exists in extreme Kerr. Now, what could be the case, and I guess this is a more complicated analysis that we haven't completely finished, is that you could imagine that you have a family of solutions that are also defined, that describe fields that are also defined away from extremality. So let's call this the temperature. Now, when t goes to 0, you get the field in extreme Kerr, which is what I've been talking about, and I've been assuming that this exists. But in principle, I don't think this is likely, but in principle, you could imagine having a family of fields in full Kerr, which have the property that if you dial into extremality, the fields themselves blow up in extreme Kerr. And then, of course, they're singular, so they're not analytic. You can't play this game. But in extreme Kerr, yeah, if you assume the field exists in extreme Kerr, you can always do that. But there could be some weird reason for why the fields don't exist in extreme Kerr. Yeah, so from that expansion, the leading piece is automatically satisfying that highest weight constraint. Yeah, these group theory constraints, we initially imposed them just because this is what you usually do in ADS where you have the same symmetry groups. But here it's very physical. Essentially, this is like the critical exponent. So if you want the, yeah.
What's the F squared is negative F squared until the magnitude is of the scale set by the black hole or?
So, right, I guess I'm sorry, there's really like two parts to the talk. One is like, let's try to use this symmetry to constrain black hole physics. The other part is force-free, and I kind of rushed through the force-free part. I just wanted to show you the equations, but it's a very rich subject. So F squared is up to some constants, really B squared minus E squared. So in general, if this is positive, you can always go to a frame in which E is 0. So in that frame, F squared is like B squared.
Yeah, no, I was just asking, are you talking about electric fields that are of the same order as the same size of a black hole?
Good. So the range of applicability of force-free is very wide. So in the case of the sun, or actually in the case of a black hole, we think that, so I think the magnetic field strength of the Earth, of the Earth's magnetic field, is on the order of 1 Gauss. Black holes, such as that, even the near extremal ones, such as M87, there's a paper that just came out last month that estimates the magnetic field strength to be about 10 to 15 Gauss. So these are actually weak magnetic, I mean, they're only about 10 times stronger than the field you're sitting in right now.
Yeah, no, well, okay, so I mean, well, but, okay, maybe it's not obvious. The reason I'm asking is Schrödinger pair protection. So this is at least the reason I would give for, you know, why aren't there any charged black holes? Well, because we know that if you have anything astrophysical size,
yeah. So when I was drawing this cartoon, and I said some words, which are exactly the words you're saying. I think the way it works is that there's a general argument due to Wald. So suppose you have some matter in this disk and it's spinning. Just grant me that there will be some magnetic field lines. Just give me a B. Okay. As soon as there's a B, I can get off the ground due to following argument. So Wald showed that whenever you put a rotating black hole in a background magnetic field, you're also going to generate an electric field. And moreover, this electric field will be perpendicular to the magnetic field. But what that means is that you'll have a Lorentz force, which will accelerate particles. So that means that charged particles that get scraped off the disk will get accelerated away. As they do so, they're going to radiate. And these photons will have very high energy. And so up to a certain radius, the photons are energetic enough that they can pair produce. So this is why you get the plasma, because there's pair production. So then you're going to populate the region around the black hole with Schwinger pairs. And once you have enough of them, they're going to screen the E field so that E dot B will go back to being zero, and then this process stops. Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, that's right. So the way you would, okay, the way we want to argue that this solution is okay, is by saying the following: these force-free equations, they're really a macroscopic description of the system. You have some current, J, which is a total aggregate current of the plasma, but you don't know what the plasma is made of. So if you want to go to the next level, there's these equations called the Vlasov equations, which are slightly more complicated. I'm not going to write them down. But essentially, what you do is you say, give me an F mu nu that describes an electromagnetic field configuration. Then let me pick a distribution of matter that's charged, and which is such that when I drop it into this background F mu nu, and I let each particle in the plasma evolve according to the Lorentz force trajectory, each particle will produce some small current. I then compute the total current by averaging over all the particles' trajectories. And that total macroscopic current, J, had better be the one that sources the field F mu nu. So these are the equations. These are called the Vlasov equations. And you want to self-consistently solve them. If you find a self-consistent solution to these equations, then you know that it is possible to set up fields and matter such that the solution is steady or stable. Right? Because I have a field F, particles in this field follow trajectories which are such that they source the J that produces that F. Yeah, well, yeah, I guess it would. Yeah. Well, okay, so this is probably a hard question to address, because already the story I was talking about, these Vlasov equations, they're really hard to solve, which is why we haven't completely nailed this yet. And that's a classical computation. So I think classically you're fine, but if you introduce quantum effects, yeah, I'm not really sure. Yeah. Thank you.